Welcome to the HR Power Hour, presented by Career Management Associates. I'm David Chulo. It's about all things in the human resource world. We're going to bring in local, regional, and national guests, and we're going to talk about a variety of topics and explain why human resource management is critical to your business success so that you can make decisions to keep and retain great talent. You're listening to the HR Power Hour presented by CMAcareer.com and Maine.DaleCarnegie.com. Today we have one of our favorite guests back, Jim Reedy from Sheehan Finney. He's an employment attorney and he's going to be talking about the 10 essential workplace policies and why every employer needs them. Jim, welcome back to the show.
Thanks, Dave. Great to be back with you.
No, I'm really glad to have you back on. What's going on as we head into the fall here, early October? You know, it's a lot going on in the HR world, wouldn't you say?
Yeah, there is. And I think that, you know, we've seen a lot of changes in the law in the last year. But if you look back even the last 25 years for HR professionals that have been in the business that long, they've seen, I think, a pretty dramatic change in that the number of workplace laws and regulations that have been adopted in that period of time is pretty significant. But more importantly, in the last year, we've seen not only new laws, but also proposed laws and regulations, and it makes your head spin.
You know what I've noticed as a trend, and maybe you can tell me if you're seeing it as well, it's not only about the federal government passing laws, it's really at the state level. There seems to be this barrage of state laws that are trying to almost compete with federal law to who could be the stricterest.
I think that's true, and I think that, you know, without being partisan here, you can look at what's happening in Congress, and that the current Congress is no different from the last Congress in that they can't seem to get anything through, meaning pass a bill through both houses and then to the president's desk, whether it's the President Obama or now President Trump. So what's happened is, you know, that nature abhors a vacuum where the federal government is not stepping up in certain areas. The state governments do. I'm talking about in the legislative area, because in the regulatory area in the last 8 years, the federal agencies were very busy. That has also slowed down under the new administration, but state agencies and state legislatures are very busy. So from coast to coast, from California to New England, we're seeing a number of new legislative initiatives, and often it follows what's called a uniform law. So a lobbying group will go from state to state trying to adopt or propose new legislation. And the legislation that I'm focused on right now is, in addition to legalizing marijuana in the various states, now it's paid family medical leave. So it was last year it was paid sick leave. Now it's paid family medical leave. And we're seeing that pop up in many states.
Well, you know, it also becomes a challenge when you have employers that have employees in multiple states, right? So the questions always come, what laws are we going to do in this state that affect other states, and how do we enforce them in different states? And that becomes even more of a challenge, not only with the laws you talk about having to do with family leave or, you know, personal leave or medical or marijuana laws. It just becomes a challenge. Do we enforce it in one? Do we enforce it in another? You know, as we get talking about these policies, how should organizations or companies think about that?
Well, it really sort of depends. Actually, I'll tell you as a quick aside, I had a CEO recently talk to me, and they were talking about expansion. And they said, I want you to map out among the 50 states the most employer-friendly states. So they were actually avoiding the problem by avoiding certain states. I have another CEO that moved one operation from California to Nevada, saying that we just have to get out of California. It's crazy here, the number of laws that apply to the workplace. But going back to sort of the norm, a lot of employers or organizations that have operations in several states, they have basically two options. Because state law does differ generally from state to state, they have two options. One is to have a set of policies that apply generally and with an appendix of some sort for the particular issues in those states, or separate handbooks. The problem with that is the more paper, the more policy, the potential more confusion. But on the other side of the ledger, you've got, but we need compliance, because if we're not in compliance, we didn't understand the laws of this state or understand the particulars of this county or this agency, we run the risk of audits and civil penalties.
You know, it really is a challenge. But the reality is that it is what we have to do as employers. And nobody said business would be easy, by the way. And certainly we can certainly say it's not, especially in HR. And, you know, the other part that I've noticed as we're talking about, you know, essential workplace policies is that that has even changed over the years. And that what is essential or what we thought to be in the top 10, maybe 10 years ago, or even 5 years ago, maybe even 2 years ago, as we talk about the 10 today, there may be a surprise or two in here today as to what people may think is essential.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think that it's really just like anything else. It's responding to changes in our culture, whether it's things that seem more important now than they did, say, 10 years ago, changes in technology. And one of the changes in our culture is not only state law and federal law and regulations, but also our society generally has become more litigious. So as a result, the ranking or the priorities of what are the most essential policies, in my humble opinion, probably would be different now than they were 10 years ago. I think that's right.
No, it's absolutely true. And it's something that is essential for HR to know today. You know, I think back of what HR needed to know as a group 5 years ago, 10 years ago, and what they need to know today is totally different about the level of legal knowledge they need.
Yep. And so in that regard, people like me will always have some degree of work or busyness because it's an ever-changing landscape. And I think HR used to be about recruitment, retention, and sort of third on the depth chart would be compliance. Compliance is number one. And recruitment, retention, motivation, and other things sort of are subordinated.
Well, there's a lot of dangerous compliance challenges out there, right? I mean, you bring up some. We've talked about FLSA, health insurance, immigration, other areas that you bring up. How do you bring it together and come up with this top 10 list?
A lack of sleep, lots of coffee, and an active imagination. I think it's really just experiential, based upon the experience I've had in practicing for nearly 30 years and seeing the changes in the marketplace and dealing with HR professionals every day and seeing what ends up in court, what is vexing or harassing to an employer, where there's confusion or contention. I think that's where I come up with the list.
No, I understand. And so, I mean, obviously, let's start, right? What's the first one do you think would be the first essential workplace policy and why the employer needs to make sure they have it?
Yeah, so I think it's a quick disclaimer. We say that, you know, not all employment laws and regulations apply to every workplace, of course. And so it depends on the nature of the organization, the number of employees you have, and where you're located, the states you talked about. And there are certainly good reasons to have more than 10. We came up with the 10 essentials. So I think the one that everyone, if you polled your HR audience, which of course is extensive, and you would ask them, you know, what's an essential policy if you had to list, they would come up with perhaps this one, which is an EEO, sexual harassment, anti-discrimination policy and complaint procedure. And by that, what I mean is it's not just sex harassment, it's all forms of protected class discrimination and an effective complaint procedure.
When somebody's looking at that, what do they really need to have in that? Because, you know, I've seen a million policies. I've seen a million different processes. And by the way, I do think there is a difference between policy and process. And I do think you have to define both. What do you see as critical to this?
I think that why you need one would be the workplace is likely covered under state or federal law. And therefore, you should outline what is protected and what's not. It's these forms of discrimination, of course, is nearly 100,000 filed across the country each year on a federal level and perhaps equal or more on a state level. So it could be required by state law to have that. You want to certainly address those issues. But you need to let employees know what conduct is not tolerated. You need to give managers and supervisors some sort of heads up as to direction on how to police the workplace. If you have an effective policy like this, you could actually shield the company from or the workplace from liability. If you have an effective complaint procedure and the person doesn't come forward and follow through, then the answer is, then how could the workplace have fixed the problem? And then newer issues like you talked about, like bullying, sexual orientation, or even transgender discrimination, which of course are new topics in some regards, addressing those and updating your policy in that regard.
When somebody's looking at policies and they say, where can I find one, Jim? I mean, there's a lot of stuff on the internet. As I like to say, there's too much on the internet. You know, you can look for a policy anywhere and find almost anything. How should somebody really go about looking at a policy that really covers everything that it should be there?
Well, I think good resources are like HR Power Hour, competent professionals like yourself, your local HR associations. Most importantly, you need to know, does it apply to your organization? Because there's cookie-cutter stuff out there, and there's a lot of junk out there. And I compare it to this. My wife likes going to antique stores and thrift stores and the like, and she drags me in to these places, and I quickly become a seven-year-old saying, are we done yet? But as I walk around, I think, it's mostly junk. Yeah, I understand that this was good at one point or that, but occasionally you do find a gem. But there is a lot of junk in these places and often overpriced. And if I bring it home, it's just going to clutter my house. So similarly, I think you have to be careful about what is out there, as you said. So you have to understand, women, who are we and what laws apply to us? I think that's the critical part. And with that, what fits our culture? And how would this also fit with, as we integrate it with other workplace policies and procedures, and also are our managers and supervisors on board? Is this a workable one for our organization? Because what might work well for a Fortune 500 or Fortune 100 doesn't work for a large not-for-profit, and so on. So, I mean, that's a short answer for there's a lot of good stuff out there, but there's also a lot of junk out there.
One of the things that you certainly mentioned within this is outlining an effective complaint procedure. I think that's critical and missed by a lot of organizations. Can you talk a little about why that's so important and why people sometimes miss that part of it?
Well, yeah, I mean, you cannot assume that all employees know where to go, and I think the courts have basically lined up that someone may suffer in silence, and unless you outline to them an effective complaint procedure, meaning not just one person, because that one person may be the bad actor in the organization, you know, where you file the complaints. So have a couple of outlets where someone can file a complaint. You don't have it where the third shift people try to go to HR, but HR is closed during third shift and so on. So whether it's a hotline or the designated supervisor on shift and so on, that's where it goes. And again, having a backup as well. I think those are important. If you have a truly workable and reasonable complaint procedure, you could shield your organization from liability, saying, the standard is what we knew or should have known, but we couldn't have known if we had this complaint procedure and the person waited X number of years to come forward. So it actually does shield the organization from liability in large part. There have been a number of Supreme Court cases on that issue, and it's a thing called constructive knowledge. And the question is, once that complaint is filed, even if it's filed with a low-level supervisor, it's as if the CEO or the board of directors or trustees knew about it at the same time. So that then starts the clock of a prompt and appropriate response. So it's an effective complaint procedure where it's filed, and that what's a prompt and appropriate response. And then the most important thing is that we've seen in recent years is guarding against retaliation after the fact. So you've reprimanded the bad actor, you've corrected the situation, then you must monitor afterwards. So that's the number one policy, and the critical elements would be confirming what laws apply, providing guidance on what conduct is prohibited, and where you file complaints, and what the consequences for noncompliance are, and then monitoring against retaliation afterwards.
Absolutely covers it right to a T. All right, the second most essential HR policy is?
You may not, this one may not trip off the tongue for most, but when you think of it, it's an essential policy for all HR departments, and that's benefits. Oftentimes, benefits end up being more important, believe it or not, than salary or hourly compensation, and principally in the area of health care. But if we're going to talk about it, it's health, life, disability, paid leave, and so on. So it's the other stuff that goes into your general compensation package. And especially health insurance is critical for a lot of employees, given the very cost of any type of health care coverage. So you need to define who is eligible for benefits. And, of course, under the ACA, the Affordable Care Act, it's full-time employees working at least 30 hours in a work week for the covered employers with at least 50 or more employees. And then it helps with recruitment and retention. In a market like ours right now, where I work in New Hampshire, in some counties, unemployment is at record low numbers, meaning 1.7% unemployment, where full employment is 4%. That means it is a buyer's market for purposes of employees shopping around for their next job. So employers have to be more creative about their recruitment and retention, and oftentimes the selling point is benefits. It also helps support classification decisions. You have to treat all classes of employees the same way. So you may have one class that gets this Cadillac type of benefit, another gets a lesser form, and so on. But you have to spell out, you know, whether it's full-time versus part-time or seasonal versus year-round and so on. So it's important to sort of spell that out.
As you said, this is not one that somebody might have thought of initially right out of the gate. What could really happen if they don't have something that really focuses on a policy for eligibility for benefits?
So we call it the Microsoft problem. And years ago, Microsoft hired a lot of independent contractors along with their employees. And the employees got stock options, and the independent contractors did not. Well, when Microsoft took off, that was a very significant issue, and they independent contractors sued and said, we're working in a cubicle right next to the employees. What's the difference? In the healthcare area, you could basically make the same arguments. Like, wait a minute, I effectively work year-round. I know I was hired as a temp, but I'm really a full-time employee, and I've basically worked over 30 hours every week for the X number of weeks in the last year, and now I have a catastrophic healthcare issue, and I should have been covered. You could have disputes over benefits, you could have unfunded liabilities, and it could erode the classifications when between classes when you make exceptions to the rule. Yeah, I know we hired her as a temp, but gosh, she's been here for 7 years. I think we ought to treat her as a full-time employee. And then other temps might say, well, then if you're going to treat her that way, why aren't you treating me that way? And so on. So it's not only the policy, but it's also whether or not you depart from the policy in practice.
So when someone's thinking about this, what are the essential elements?
They would be basically spelling out what policies are included. You state clearly who's eligible and how that's measured. You reference the plan documents, because, again, in the handbook, you're not going to have the plan documents. And the other thing is your providers will change, of course, and so over time. So you mentioned that the benefits are subject to change. Over time, and that questions with regard to the particular benefits should be directed to human resources.
We're talking with Jim Reedy. He is the HR employment attorney in the great state of New Hampshire and across the Northeast. Is that a big enough title for you, Jim?
I'll take it.
Okay. And he works with the great firm of Sheehan Finney, a great sponsor of the HR Power Hour. You're listening to the HR Power Hour on News Talk WLOB 100.5 FM. And we will be right back.
At 154 years old, Verrill Dana has an illustrious history and more than seven generations of legal expertise. With more than 130 attorneys across seven offices from Maine to Washington, D.C., Verrill Dana serves clients across the country and around the world. HR professionals, business leaders, and in-house counsel count on Verrill Dana, one of the premier labor and employment law practices in the Northeast. Contact them today at verrilldana.com.
And we're back, and you're listening to the HR Power Hour, our news talk, WLOB 100.5 FM, and presented by CMAcareer.com and Maine.DaleCarnegie.com. Today we're talking with Jim Reedy. He is the employment attorney at Sheehan Finney in the great state of New Hampshire and covering the Northeast. Jim, you know, we're talking about 10 most essential HR policies and why they're important. We've talked about the first two. Number three, you say, is wage, hour, and record-keeping policy. You know, immediately when you say that, I start getting shakes.
Yeah, I think that it's a good one, too, because the risk to organizations on a federal and state level of unpaid wages is pretty significant. The U.S. Department of Labor has been more active in recent years with its audits, and likewise in most states, their departments of labor have been out there looking at everything from overtime pay to work breaks, meal breaks, failure to keep accurate records of hours worked, shift differentials, holiday pay, and so on. And the civil penalties are staggering. The wage adjustments are significant. And oftentimes employers are, well, you know, that's the way it's always been, and they look for the records and there's nothing there. The other thing that complicates it is the U.S. Department of Labor in recent years came out with their own app. And, of course, everybody's got a smartphone, and on the app you can track your hours. And what if you had your own HRIS tracking system for hours and the person didn't follow along? However, they use those extra hours, meaning before and after normal scheduled time, and they said they were working, and they tracked the U.S. Department of Labor app. The Department of Labor adopts that as, yeah, that's a good record. So you can have anything. You can write on an envelope. You can write on the back of a check, hours worked. And if that's a record, unless you've got something to rebut that the person wasn't working, you could have unfunded liability. And the issue is that it can go 3 or 4 years back for purposes of paying those wages. So it's important, and it's been a hot spot for compliance, but also just a hot button issue for HR. So in the policy, you want to make it clear hours of work, the schedule, the hours of work, spell out rates, overtime, shift differential, holiday pay, the things that, you know, it's the things that nip at your heels, but they're important. As we saw in the last year with the overtime classification changes, proposed changes that again have stalled since last November, but there was a 2-year windup for those. A lot of employers were scrambling to make certain changes. Some did, some went back and changed it back to the old way. Some didn't and waited for the law to change. But make it clear who's eligible for overtime and who's not, and what that means. Underscore the importance of daily timekeeping for those employees that have to track their time daily from the beginning of the day to the end of the day with any bona fide meal break and other breaks greater than 20 minutes, and to comply basically with the Fair Labor Standards Act and state law. And again, that's from your opening comments. State laws sometimes are more protective than federal laws. So you have to look at the differences there too.
You know, it's interesting when it comes to this area specifically. There's a lot of things that can happen to an organization if they don't really follow this policy. They're really exposed, aren't they?
Oh, absolutely. And would you want to be the HR person going to the CFO or CEO saying, oh, by the way, we owe hundreds of thousands of dollars to the employees for the last couple of years? You know, that's a career-ending move, as they say. So it's significant. The statistics from state and federal DOL in the last couple of years have been, it's been amazing the amounts that we're talking about for wage claims and monies riding out of audits. It also comes up where you have people that are misclassified as being overtime exempt when they should have been overtime eligible.
That's a big piece of the puzzle too, right? From a compensation standpoint, making sure that you really take a look at what your compensation policy is and how you classify people. It's not just the policy itself, but it's how you classify them.
Absolutely. And it's monitoring daily. And it's really engaging the supervisor to say, you've got to look at the clock. You've got to see what's involved. You've got to see if there's a missed punch. You've got to see if someone, either forgot to punch in or punched out. And even then, you look at state law saying, okay, how do we correct this and how do we notify the employee and so on? And then making certain that continuum from the daily time record to the actual paycheck to make certain that that is done properly. So that's the beginning of it. That's the record, and that's the most important record. The problem with this whole system is it's the employer's liability, but who keeps the record? The employee does. So keeping an eye to make certain that he or she is actually recording their time. So what could happen without one? You could have wage claims. You could have poor attendance because things are not monitored properly. Exposure to a Department of Labor audit and potential for unpaid wages and also for civil penalties, and they can be significant. And the FedEx case of a few years ago that went to the Supreme Court ultimately dealt with misclassification for independent contractors, but it also went to overtime issues. And it was, you might see how your overnight delivery costs went up principally because of things like that, because of the exposure the company had. These are not employers that are out trying to cheat. It's just these are oftentimes innocent bookkeeping mistakes or oversights.
So as we're talking about the 10 most essential HR policies, number 3, wage, hour, and record timekeeping, what are the essential elements that somebody has to look at?
Hours of work, days of work, confirming the timekeeping and overtime policies, how to correct the record, how to enter the record, how to correct the record, confirming overtime classifications, who's exempt, who's eligible for overtime, and cross-referencing your attendance policy and other related work-related policies. So everything from calling in during inclement weather to reporting in and then being told to go home, but there's reporting pay potential issues and so on. So those would be the most important ones.
Number 4, Jim, oh, my favorite, FMLA, Family and Medical Leave Policy.
Yeah, or otherwise FMLA known as Forgive My Last Absence. I think that it's been around since 93. And so, you know, you're coming on the 25th anniversary of the FMLA. I agree with you that most HR professionals consider it to be the bane of their existence because it's up to 12 weeks of leave. But as you said at the outset, some state laws actually are more expansive. California and others, even as close to us in Rhode Island, Massachusetts, have more expansive family leave policy, Small Necessities Act, and so on. So you have to look very carefully at those. So you have to look at both the federal, whether or not you're covered by the federal 50 or more employees, or you're covered by the state laws, which may have a threshold of fewer employees, say 25 or so on. And you have to look at the administrative rules. Why? Because under the FMLA, if you have a handbook and you're covered by the FMLA, your FMLA policy, among other places, belongs in the handbook. And you have to outline your request procedures for taking leave, and it helps to avoid confusion or issues with why leave was denied, and you want to outline that pretty clearly in that policy. And there are a lot of, to your point earlier, Dave, there's a lot of sample policies out there. The best place to look for that one would be the U.S. Department of Labor website has a sample FMLA policy.
No, that's great, and I think it's important because this is not one of those ones where you really should just get a policy off the internet, to be honest with you.
No. Right?
You really need to take the time and have this one reviewed properly. These are one of those policies where you can get in a lot of trouble. And I guess that's one of the questions I would ask. What could actually happen if you don't have one?
You know, you could have, well, invasion of privacy claims. You could have a disability claim for asking questions about someone's illness and the like. You could have unchecked leave time. Cases that have come up in recent years is if you don't properly designate FMLA under your policy, the person not only gets FMLA at that point, but all the time before that is basically forgiven and protected. And you could also have what's called FMLA interference or retaliation claims that you didn't properly notify the person, or that, you know, you didn't get the proper certificate from the physician, and you didn't apply leave time properly, and so on. It is an absolute nightmare. It's a wreck on the interstate for sure in the HR world. So I think the essential elements of those policies would be again confirming which laws, federal and state, that apply to you, and I would say and state to the extent that the state law is offers more protection. Outline eligibility and who's covered by the benefits. As you know, not every employee is covered initially by the FMLA. And then cross-reference, again, your attendance and other leave policies, because that can be an awkward intersection unless you properly address those. I think those are essential elements to your FMLA and related family and parental leave policies.
Yeah, and I just want to reiterate, this is one where you really need a good relationship with your attorney, because these are so incredibly important policies that should be reviewed if you're rewriting it. And that's one of those that you can't skimp on. I just think you can get yourself in so much trouble.
Right, and the pressure for HR always is from, you know, perhaps the boardroom or CEO or CFO. It's like, look, don't engage a lawyer. Just get something and, you know, apply it. Or here's the handbook I had from my last company. Just use those policies. And I agree, it's very dangerous to do that.
You know, I got to tell you, Jim, just as a side note in terms of something that you will smile about, we recently went to an employer. We're going to rewrite their handbook, and it's wonderful from, obviously, the CMA side. And I looked at their – and I asked for a copy of their current handbook, and it was 1993. So they've still been using the same one since 1993. Do you remember the green and white paper that comes out of a printer with the dots on every side out of the matrix? That's what it was printed on. So that was,
I would imagine. You could even have it where it's still wet from the mimeograph machine that it sort of rolled off. To your point, it's almost better off not to have that policy and to start from scratch.
Well, exactly right. Literally, I've asked for it if I can put it under glass in the office as a treasure, because I think that would be perfect. But at this point, we're just starting from scratch, really, in terms of it.
It's right.
Just, there's no other way to really look at it at that point. And you know what? No harm to the employer itself from the standpoint that they don't know what they don't know, and they've used it for years. They're a great organization. They just don't know what they don't know. They didn't have an HR person. This is a critical thing. These are out there. I tell you, there are employers who don't know what they don't know.
Oh, sure. And I think that, and again, like you said, it's well-intended. We've always done it that way, which, by the way, is never a defense in court. There's an opportunity for a fresh start here.
Absolutely.
I think that's a good one.
All right, number five, alcohol and drug policies. Again, we're talking about 10 most essential HR policies with Jim Reedy from Sheehan Finney.
Yeah, and talk about an opportunity for a fresh start. I mean, who would have guessed as close as 5 years ago that we'd be talking about the number of states that have approved medical marijuana and recreational marijuana, and those states, those numbers will change in this year and next. Who would have guessed that you'd have that proliferation of legalized marijuana? And that has changed a lot of workplaces. The other is the opioid epidemic that this country is facing. The impact it has on our communities, our workplaces, our families, pretty significant. And so employers need to, whether they've got a policy from 1993 or even 2015, 2016, they ought to look at their policy and say, do we need to update it? I have clients right now that are saying, with operations in Maine and Massachusetts and other states as well, where there is legalized recreational marijuana, we're not testing for marijuana anymore in the workplace, which is understandable, but it's also potentially dangerous too. So look at your policy. Let's see, have we outlined what is acceptable, what's unacceptable? Have we talked about the consequences of misconduct? Do we make it clear? Do we have a drug and alcohol policy? Because a lot of employers do not. And it reinforces your safety and attendance policies, and that is important. If you don't have it, you could have disparate treatment claims. You could have safety infractions. You could have imputed liability and negligence. And what do I mean by that? You could have a situation where, employer, you should have known, or you should have enforced your policy, and your employee was under the influence of drugs and alcohol and caused property or injury to individuals, and hopefully not something horrible and catastrophic, but the employer could be held liable for the bad acts of the employee that were not detected and corrected by the employer.
So as we talk about this, what are the essential elements that somebody needs to focus on?
You know, can you say zero tolerance anymore? My view is you still can, meaning that, and it's sort of a simplistic view, but that's how my little brain works. I think of it as alcohol is legal. Since the repeal of prohibition. That being said, you can say you cannot be under the influence of alcohol while at work. Similarly, you can say the same about everything from prescription drugs to over-the-counter drugs that might be cause some level of impairment to illicit drugs. And so making it clear, what do we mean by drugs? What do we mean by alcohol? What do we mean by impairment and so on? You reference state laws to the extent that applies, and state laws vary, and you reserve the right to test, and what are the consequences of nonconformance with the policy. And again, that varies by state law. In Maine, of course, you cannot fire an employee for the first failed drug test, and there are requirements with EAP that follow afterwards, and so other states have similar policies. In Vermont, you have to give notice in advance of proposed drug testing 10 days in advance, which is kind of laughable, and so on. But this is a rapidly changing area of the law. So the essential elements would be basically defining your expectations for conduct in the workplace and work-related activities, meaning outside of your workspace.
We're talking with Jim Reedy. We're talking about 10 most essential HR policies that you need to implement. You're listening to the HR Power Hour on News Talk WLOB 100.5 FM, and we will be right back.
Founded in 1958, Jackson Lewis is a national law firm with a local presence. The firm's 765 attorneys practicing in 54 locations throughout the U.S. and Puerto Rico provide a wide range of resources to address every aspect of the employer-employee relationship. HR professionals, business and in-house counsels, and C-suite professionals count on Jackson Lewis as it has one of the most active employee litigation practices in the United States. Contact them today at jacksonlewis.com. That's jacksonlewis.com.
And we're back, and you're listening to the HR Power Hour on News Talk WLOB 100.5 FM and presented by CMAcareer.com and Maine.DaleCarnegie.com. We're talking with Jim Reedy. He is employment attorney with Shee & Finney. And we're talking about 10 most essential HR policies that you need to make sure that you implement properly in the workplace. Jim, we've gone through the first five, but number six is always important because it's so critical to the safety and well-being of employees, and it's workplace safety policy and reporting procedures.
Workplace safety policy, of course. What did our mother say? It was only funny till someone loses an eye. You know, it's oftentimes the overlooked part in most workplaces, and certainly in a white collar workplace. But there are OSHA and other state law safety standards that should be complied with. So you have to look at your industry, your company safety expectations, and outline them. And whether that's safety equipment, protective gear and equipment, or just where to report known hazards, or if you're injured in any way, where to report that.
You know, last year I know they had an increase in the fines for OSHA. And so I think that's important that people remember that it can cost you real money.
Oh, sure. And they could be pretty significant. And OSHA historically has been unbending in their sort of orthodox approach to workplace safety, and perhaps for good reason. I'll take out the word perhaps for good reason, that their job is to protect the individual. But employers, there's a high standard for detecting and correcting workplace hazards. And that's true on the state level as well. So I think that's a pretty straightforward one, I think, just outlining what your safety policies and procedures are, where you report accident or illness, you know, your duty to report hazardous conditions, and you cross-reference your workers' comp and your complaint procedures. And that's, I think that's pretty straightforward.
Yeah, it really is. And, you know, I always tell people the last thing you want to do is be a employer that doesn't take safety seriously, right? Because that's one of the worst things that come out in headlines of the newspaper, right?
We want to make sure
that this is something that, if you want to be a best place to work, if you want to be a place that's seen as the right place, you want to take safety seriously.
Yes, that's true. The next one up is also one that would be sort of a one that people would think of off the top of their head, which would be performance management, discipline, and termination procedures. But basically, that is outlining what the expectations are. And I think of this as the professor outlining the syllabus and going through, and this is how you will be graded, this is how you will be judged, and this is what happens if you don't show up for class or you don't turn in your term paper. And that's really it in the – so, you know, and sadly, in our culture, you have – and I've had many of these cases where it says, well, where in the handbook does it say I can't do that? Well, you don't have to write everything in your handbook, but you do need to say that – this is our workplace, these are our work rules, and this is the this is how you will be evaluated. These are our expectations, and we'll make it clear what the consequences are for non-performance or non-compliance, and outlines what our ordinary steps are for purposes of discipline and correction, and that we reserve the right to bypass those in certain circumstances. So we don't have to give you the verbal, written suspension, termination. You can go from step one to termination right away under certain circumstances.
You know, Jim, this one topic brings up one point that I would like you to just talk about a little. A lot of organizations get concerned of how they have to be consistent among discipline for similar situations across the platform. And you just talked about the times it's okay to go from first to the final in situations. How critical is it for organizations or HR professionals to think about their consistency in the delivery of the discipline or the delivery of the issue across the platform?
Yeah, I think that you want to avoid what's called disparate treatment claims where, say, someone in a protected group, an older worker, a person of what's considered to be a minority race in the workplace, or someone with disability and so on, has a harsher treatment than someone who's not, like, say, a Caucasian under age 40 and so on. So you want to watch out for disparate treatment claims, that you've been harsher on certain groups or individuals than others. And then the old expression, you know, consistency is the hobgoblin of little minds, but consistency is critical to HR to avoid problems. And that doesn't mean robotic consistency, where it's like, in every instance, we must do the following. It's just you have to go through a proper vetting process.
No, it's great. I think that's very important because I see a lot of HR professionals get caught up in that discussion to be, you know, how do we be consistent but also apply the policy differently? So that explains that. Okay, number eight, conflict of interest, confidentiality, trade secrets, and non-disclosure policy. This is one, to be honest with you, that a lot of people may not have thought of.
Right, because it's sort of an afterthought. But I think making it clear, you can't work for a competitor when you work for us, that we treat certain information confidential, or it's proprietary, which means we have an ownership interest in it, and there are certain trade secrets that we would want to keep from the general public knowing, or for you benefiting or profiting from as you leave our workplace or share with others, and that goes under what's called a non-disclosure policy. So it's critical to make it clear, define what is confidential, what is proprietary, what is a work for hire, meaning you don't own the intellectual property rights. We do, because we gave you the money, the facilities, the equipment, and so on. We want to protect our trade secrets, and if we need to enforce them later, we have to show that we had a policy and we were consistent.
What are some of the essential elements of somebody who's writing that type of policy, though?
Yeah, really just sort of defining what's confidential, what's proprietary, the employee's duty to protect the information, the employer's duty to protect the information, confirming that you must outline when you get hired what inventions or other things you had before, because once you set foot here and we invest in you, it becomes our property, and that you have to sign over certain rights. And then what are your post-employment obligations? And that comes up, and that's the most important part, that you can, as you leave, you can't go to a competitor and do the brain drain where you share all of these secrets, that there are consequences that if, you know, to make it clear that you cannot share all the, you know, the information that the company has invested so much in. You can't just go next door and share that information or, again, profit yourself.
You know, it's interesting with so many different state laws applying to these things. Is it hard for an employer to look at this and say, hey, we can have one policy across all states?
This one is one where you potentially could. But you want to look at the Uniform Trade Secrets Act, and that most states have adopted that. You want to see if your state has adopted that, because it has additional policies and procedures involved. But this one, I think, is fairly universal most employers can adopt. But again, the word of caution is what you said earlier, is just be careful about where you find that policy. It's one size doesn't fit all, meaning the one that, again, a tech company may have or a medical devices company may have may not apply to your workplace.
You're absolutely right. And again, we're talking with Jim Reedy from Sheehan Finney, employment attorney, and we're talking about 10 most essential HR policies. I'm your host, David Chulo. You know, the number nine you have is electronic equipment use monitoring and bring your own device policy.
Right, and this is what you said earlier, Dave, that perhaps 10 years ago this would not have been an issue or at the top of the list. You know, 10 years ago, most employers had personal computers or networked computers for sure, and therefore under federal and state law, you had to outline that this is the company's equipment and that we'll be monitoring it, and that includes all sent, received, and stored images and messages and the like, and you could be disciplined for doing things that are not in accord with the company's best interests, or if you're basically not working during work time. But now it's gone beyond that to smartphones, and with the changes in technology and how mobile the workforce is, you have to be very clear as to setting the employee's expectation for privacy, because what you may have on the company computers may now end up on the smartphone, and you may say, okay, let's be clear that you need to, one, protect the company information, just like in that policy above. It has to comply with federal and state laws that might be in there. You have to outline that we can still monitor your smartphone because it's just like a mobile computer, and you have to notify them of what's called the remote wipe, which comes from the BYOD, which is bring your own device policy. So if it's not a company-supplied smartphone, but it's my smartphone that the company allows me to have access to the computer system, the company, because they want to protect their interests, and one of the interests is if you've left the company and on that handheld device, that smartphone or other tablet, you may have company information. The company can flip a switch and do what's called a remote wipe and wipe out everything on that device. It's a kill switch. But the problem is you could also lose your, personal photographs and personal information. So making it clear to say, look, unless you turn over that device to have things removed, company information removed, we might have to do the kill switch, and you might lose personal information.
Jim, as we talk about this segment here, having to do with cell phones, have you seen companies bring more about having them use their own personal devices or having them use company devices? And that's an argument I hear with HR and operations all the time.
Yeah, I think that the there are two schools of thought. One is the cost of supplying cell phones, more so smartphones to individuals, and then recovering them afterwards. But the HR argument in that regard is we can control them better if we own the phone. And it's better, easier to monitor, easier to collect the phone back. The problem with that is you have an employee that's been there for a number of years and has used the company-provided smartphone as his or her own personal device. Oftentimes, they don't want to part with it because, again, they've kept photographs on it or they've used it as their device, and they look at either keeping it and the company having to retain it or buying it out or something like that, and it gets pretty awkward. So there's a real split in the marketplace as to providing, but a lot of employers have been resistant simply because of the cost involved. As the cost comes down, more employers are looking to provide that as a recruitment and retention tool.
No, it's no question. I just thought I'd ask the question because it is the big question today of which way should they go. Again, we're listening to the HR Power Hour. We're talking with Jim Reedy from Sheehan Finney, and we will be right back. From News Talk, WLOB 100.5 FM.
Founded in 1958, Jackson Lewis is a national law firm with a local presence. The firm's 765 attorneys practicing in 54 locations throughout the U.S. and Puerto Rico provide a wide range of resources to address every aspect of the employer-employee relationship. HR professionals, business and in-house counsels, and C-suite professionals count on Jackson Lewis as it has one of the most active employee litigation practices in the United States. Contact them today at jacksonlewis.com. That's jacksonlewis.com.
And we're back, and you're listening to the HR Power Hour presented by CMAcareer.com and Maine.DaleCarnegie.com. We've been talking with Jim Reedy, employment attorney at Sheehan Finney, and we're talking about the 10 most essential HR policies. We've gone through the top nine, now number 10, record breach policy, electronic and paper. Talk about that, Jim.
Yeah, record breaches. It's the thing that we all dread, that you get a call that you just shopped at Target and your personal information has been hacked, and you have to go through the whole process of protecting your records, maybe getting a new credit card and the like. It's come up more and more with the IRS scams that have hit HR departments, and an email coming reportedly from the CFO or CEO asking a payroll clerk for all of the payroll information and send it to me via email, and it's really not from the CEO or COO, and the unknowing payroll clerk sends that information, and then it results in employees having their personal information abused and tax forms filed and refunds funded to the wrong person and so on, and that's just the beginning of it. So it's a nightmare. Most states have a data breach law, and employers ought to have their own data breach policy, basically to say, one, complying with the federal or state law that applies, the other, dealing with cloud storage issues, but also confirming your record retention expectations and the consequences for noncompliance, the importance of protecting password, and most importantly, when in doubt, talk to HR before you disclose any personal information with regard to yourself or other employees.
You know, we have a bonus one, I know, telecommuting and remote access policy. Tell us about that.
Well, just that more and more the workplace is becoming more fluid and less traditional, and employees preferring not to be brick-and-mortar employees, but to work from home and the like, or to have a flex week. And so the importance of basically saying that if that is permitted, who it's permitted for, how you request that information, and how you properly use company equipment and systems, and the employer has the right to revoke or change these arrangements, and confirming hours of work, reporting, integration, and other things. It's just a reflection of a change in our culture, but employers use it for recruitment and retention, saying we will allow these flex type of arrangements.
No, and it's becoming more and more, so that's something that everybody should be focusing on. You know, as we wrap up the show today, I know you have 10 policies no workplace should ever need. What are they, Jim?
But sadly, you need to remind your employees of these, and I've seen these in my practice. Number one, there's no sleeping on the job. Number two, smoking pot or drinking alcohol on work breaks is generally frowned upon. Number three is you need to show up to work on time. Number four, lying, stealing, cheating could be grounds for discipline. Number five, no biting, pinching, slapping, tickling coworkers with or without their consent. Number six is work time is for work. Number seven is company property is not your personal property. Eight, to be treated like an adult, you need to act like one. Number nine, performance evaluations should be fair but honest. And number 10, there are consequences for noncompliance with company policies.
That's very good. And as we conclude today, what is the last thing you want to make sure that HR professionals really think about as they're getting ready to have these 10 essential workplace policies in place?
I think that obviously there's a need for more than these 10, obviously, but the most important thing is understand where your company is located, the number of employees that you have, what type of organization you have, and with that, which laws and regulations apply to you and what makes sense for your culture. Oftentimes with handbooks, even though there's been this explosion in laws, oftentimes less is more. Focus on the most important ones, the ones you need to have for purposes of enforcing your work rules and expectations and having a successful organization, and focusing on that.
Absolutely, Jim. And I want to thank you so much for being on the show again today. Again, Attorney Jim Reedy from Sheehan Finney, as always, a fantastic guest, giving great information. And again, thank you for being an HR Power Hour sponsor as well.
My pleasure. Thanks so much.
You're listening to the HR Power Hour on News Talk WLOB. And of course, you can listen to this show right afterwards at hrpowerhour.com. Get in touch with Jim himself. His information and phone number will be on the site. You're listening to the HR Power Hour on News Talk WLOB 100.5 FM. And now your HR Tip of the Week. Your HR Tip of the Week is being sponsored by VerylDana.com.
Hi, this is Tani Alvarez from VerylDana. Are you considering hiring from a competitor? If so, are you instituting best practices to decrease any possible adverse consequences? During the recruiting period, companies should ask the candidate about any possible legal restrictions on employment as soon as possible. If the employee has a non-compete or non-solicitation provision in his or her current position, it could limit the effectiveness of the employee at your organization in the future. If the candidate does have legal restrictions, it may not mean that he or she is no longer a contender for the position, but the company will want to assess whether they qualify as a competitor under the terms of the agreement and to assess the likelihood of litigation if the hire were to occur. Hint, hint, you might want to talk to counsel. But if you do decide to make the hire, make sure that you are clear with the employee as to what your expectations are and are not with regard to solicitation and the use of proprietary information from former employers. Contact myself or a member of VerylDana's Labor and Employment Practice Group to further discuss implications of hiring employees with contractual restrictions.
And that's your HR Tip of the Week, sponsored by VerylDana.com. Next week on the HR Power Hour, a very special show talking about a very special topic. Carol Schoenberg, end-of-life educator and bereavement service manager of Hospice of Southern Maine, talks about grief in the workplace. Have you ever thought of grief training your team or your organization? Did you even know it existed? Well, Grief 101 is real, and you should know why it's important. That's on the next HR Power Hour. Thank you, everyone, for listening, and catch us every week at 10 a.m. on News Talk WLOB 100.5 FM or 1310 a.m. and streaming live at WLOBradio.com. Podcasts of this show and every show are available at HRPowerHour.com. Have a great week, everyone, and remember, HR management is critical to your business's success.